Welcome back to Instant Mom, navigating solo foster and adoptive motherhood while attempting a go at sanity. And the past week or so has been definitely an attempt and not a successful effort at attempting sanity. It has been a week, guys. I'm going to talk about a lot tonight. Going to do a general life update, and then I have a quick vent about well-intended people who are trying to help foster children but are not actually helping kids in foster care. And then I'm going to go on and talk about why we are choosing to do an independent adoption in the future, potentially, and why we don't want to go with an adoption agency, because that came up last week and I thought I'd just explain it since people had questions. So first, for the quick life update. So last week, our teen, who we're calling Michelle, but again, that is not her real name, started having some really bad stomach pains and just digestive issues and was not feeling good at all, and tenderness in her belly. And so we called the pediatrician, and he said that it sounded like it could be appendicitis just because of the severity of her pain and the location. And he advised that we go to the ER. So on Thursday afternoon, we head to the emergency room and they run a couple tests. They do some blood work. We are there until 3 o'clock in the morning. And they said, well, we can't really figure out what it is. So it's probably just like a viral infection and it'll go away on its own. So they give us some pain medication and send us on our way. So Friday rolls around and I'm exhausted because we got back from the hospital at 3 a.m. And thank you to my cousin Madeline for staying here with Jack while he was sleeping. So she also stayed up until 3 a.m. Bless her heart. And I do have to say one funny note. I called one of my very good friends, whose name I will not mention here so as not to embarrass her. And I said, hey, is there any way that you can come over and just stay with Jack while he's sleeping tonight? Because we're going to be in the ER for a long time. She's like, so I would ordinarily be happy to, but I'm actually out with a guy right now and kind of drunk. So I don't think it's a good idea. I was like, yes. Although chances are slim that Jack would wake up in the middle of the night. I don't really want you here when you're wasted on the off chance that Jack would wake up. So that's a where my friends are in their stage of life. So on Friday, the pain got worse for her. I mean, she was like doubled over crying. And you could tell she was just in a ton of pain. She couldn't eat, she couldn't walk. So we go back to the emergency room and they decided to admit her. So she was there Friday and she was there most of the day on Saturday and then got discharged on Saturday evening. They ran some more tests. They thought they had a diagnosis, of a chronic condition, and they wanted her to do a few more procedures outpatient this week. They were actually scheduled for tomorrow. And then we got news today that it was not this chronic infection or chronic disease that they thought she might have, but instead a really bad case of food poisoning from E. coli. And that was actually really great news because that's a lot better than having a chronic diagnosis that you have to deal with for the rest of your life. So we were really happy about that. She is feeling so much better, pretty much 100%. And she thinks she got it from a restaurant that she was eating at. Because at first I was like, oh my God, did I make something that gave her E. coli? But the doctor assured us that it was something that bad. You know, everybody else in the household would have had it too, and we eat the same things for dinner. And she, coincidentally, Michelle, started feeling bad a few hours after eating at this one restaurant. But I guess nobody thought food poisoning because her pain was so severe and in a very specific location. But anyway, it was severe E. coli poisoning. So she is on the mend, feeling really good, and we hope that we never have to go back to the ER ever again. But they were really great to us, and you know, it was a scary situation for her, but she's feeling better. So that is really good. But it's not fun to have one kid in the hospital and then another kid that you're trying to spend time with. So I just had such mom guilt last week because I obviously wanted to be in the hospital with Michelle, and so I was, but then Jack spent, you know, pretty much 3 full days with a nanny or a babysitter, and I just felt really bad. So I tried to spend a lot of quality time with him on Sunday and this week, and he's fine, of course, but, you know, mom guilt never goes away. So that was that. And so then I had mentioned on one of my posts on Instagram that we were still interested in adopting in the future. And of course, also we were interested in adopting in the future and also interested in continuing to foster. So that's something that I want to do my entire life, as long as I am physically and logistically and financially able to. But we would like to permanently grow our family again, and I'd love to give Jack a forever sibling. And so, we looked at private adoptions, because while Jack was adopted through foster care, of course, the whole point of foster care is to reunify with the parents. And while another adoption might happen through foster care again, that's not something that you can plan on. And if you go into a new foster placement thinking and hoping for adoption, you're really not in the right mindset to be supportive of the birth parents' efforts to do better and to get better. And that's not fair to them, and it's not fair to the child. So I've been exploring private adoption, and I have decided that if we did that, we would go with a self-match. So there are a lot of ways that you can go forward with a private domestic adoption. International adoption is a whole different animal, and frankly, I know nothing about that. And I should also say that each state has different laws. So there are a few states that won't actually let you self-match. There are a few states where you have to use an agency. There are some states where you can't use a consultant. So the information that I'm going to go over is specific to Indiana. But as always, with any kind of advice or overview that I give about the adoption and foster care process, you really want to check with your local state laws to understand what is available in your state. So you can do a self-match, which is essentially you find an expectant mother who is interested in choosing adoption for her child on your own. And once you find an expectant mother and she says, yep, I would like to place my child with you, then you find an adoption attorney who makes everything legal. So that's called a self-match. You're doing all the legwork. And so you might ask, okay, well, how do you find an expectant mother? How does that work? And there are ways that you can advertise, although not all states allow you to advertise. And Indiana is actually a very gray area. So some advertising is allowed, but I kept reading the law over and over again, and it still was really unclear to me who exactly can advertise and how you can advertise. So, but a lot of people nowadays are advertising on social media. So they'll invest a lot of money in, you know, a Facebook, an Instagram, a Twitter campaign. There are lots of groups on Facebook that are meant to match hopeful adoptive parents to expectant women. And then there are also all kinds of websites and apps, weirdly similar to dating websites and apps, where hopeful adoptive parents go and sort of present their profile and pictures, and then women who are considering adoption look for a match. So those are all ways that you're doing it yourself. I work in marketing. I'm very familiar with marketing, digital marketing, social media marketing, how to promote yourself. And I just still feel really icky using any kind of advertising to match with an expectant mother, because it just seems really transactional, and just strange. I don't know. So I personally am not comfortable with doing social media marketing or any other kind of paid marketing. Also, I think it can be a little predatory. You know, we all get served ads on social media that sometimes we're like, whoa, how did they know to serve that ad to me? I just talked about this random thing the other day and now I'm getting an ad for it. Or you get an ad that's like kind of offensive and you're like, what? Like, how dare you serve me an ad for weight loss pills? I think I look great. And so whether you mean to or not, if you are doing social media advertising targeting expectant mothers, you have to
sort of stereotype that group of women, right? You might target a lower income bracket. You might target certain ages, certain geographies, different interests that you think a woman who is pregnant but not ready to parent might be interested in. And that feels wrong to me. Like, you're making a lot of assumptions about the kind of woman who might want to place her child for adoption. And also, you're going to reach a lot of women who don't want to choose adoption for their child. And that's kind of, I don't know, it just feels icky to me that women who might be in a precarious situation but do want to parent are seeing all of these ads in front of them about adoption when that might not be what they want to do. Like, that just seems a little icky. And some people, unfortunately, get super predatory with their advertising. I mean, in some of these adoption groups on Facebook that I'm a part of, I just want to shake some of these people and be like, what are you thinking? There are some people who will make a little brochure about their family, and they will drop it off at homeless shelters and rehab centers, and they will try to put it in like prison, or I'm sorry, in jail, like lobbies and all of these places where they think a woman in a precarious situation, a woman who doesn't have a lot of money, a woman who has addictions, would be. And to me, that is like super unethical. Like, is it legal? Sure, I guess it's legal. But to intentionally try to find women who are going through a really hard time and then target them for your own personal gain is just gross. And it's not okay. So I only want to connect with women who are actively looking for adoptive families. So that means that we only do websites that are meant to match adoptive families with expectant women, or groups where that happens, or also word of mouth. So if somebody has a friend of a friend or a family member or a coworker, and they know that person personally, and they know that they're thinking of adoption, then that's okay with me. But I am not going to try to actively stereotype and reach out to women or try to find women that are in desperate situations and advertise to them. Like, that's just so gross and terrible. You don't prey on people in their time of need for your own advantage and gain. Thought you shouldn't have to explain that. So the downside of this is that it might take us a very long time to find a match, and it may never happen for us. And I'm okay with that. You know, unfortunately, in the private domestic adoption world, you can get a baby just about as fast as you want to if you have enough money. And in this case, we are not willing to spend a ton of money through some unethical channels, even though they're legal. I feel that they're highly unethical to get this product, essentially, is what it feels like when you're doing that. So if it happens, if it's supposed to happen, if it's meant to happen, if somehow an expectant mother comes across us and thinks that we could be a fit, that's great. And if it never happens, we are okay with that too. Which brings me to adopting through an adoption agency. So for people who are like, yeah, that self-matching thing sounds great, but that takes a lot of luck and a lot of time and it could never happen, you can go through an adoption agency. And an adoption agency has a lot of pros to it. So first of all, you're usually going to match with an expectant mother quicker than if you did it on your own, because the agency is sort of the middleman. They have all these relationships with social workers and excuse me, guys, pregnancy centers, and they do a lot of social media advertising as an agency to try to find expectant women who are considering adoption. So they're going to be able to put your profile in front of way more women than you would be able to find on your own. Theoretically, they also offer more support to the birth mother if she decides to choose adoption. So they might have counseling services. They might be able to connect her with birth mom support groups or birth mom retreats. And that goes beyond just when she places. Those are benefits that surround that mother for a lifetime. And that is incredibly important and incredibly valuable. I think it is really tragic when hopeful adoptive parents just kind of see the mother as a means to an end. Like, yeah, we care about you in theory, but like once we get our baby, you know, best of luck and we'll pray for you. But they don't really think about what that woman might need psychologically, mentally, emotionally, financially, logistically after she signs her rights away. So adoption agencies, in theory, provide a lot of that support. However, adoption agencies are, first of all, super expensive. The average cost of a private domestic adoption, if you're going through an agency, is between $30,000 to like $50,000 and up. And this is not something you make installment plans on. This is like cash that you have to have up front. And there are a lot of ethical concerns I have with that. But even if there were no ethical concerns, you know, we don't have an extra 60 grand lying around in cash, nor are we willing to go into debt and take out a loan or put that on a credit card. And also, it just seems kind of weird that you would like take out a loan for a child. Like, I don't know. I get it because, you know, it's not just the wealthy who should be able to adopt. But at the same time, I don't know how I would feel if I was 13 years old and I saw my mom writing a check for me, basically, you know, like, we're still paying you off. Anyway, I digress. So unfortunately, a lot of these big adoption agencies are very profitable. These are not nonprofits. Now, there are some adoption agencies that have a nonprofit status and they charge on an income adjusted basis. So they can be much less expensive, although still in like at least the 20 grand area, depending on your income. But many of these agencies are huge profit centers. There is a big agency here in town. They do both foster care and private adoptions, and foster care adoptions are a completely different thing. They are free or like $2,000 most, but they do a lot of private adoptions and they're very big, and their lawyers are very wealthy. And I was actually talking to a woman who had worked at this adoption agency for years and years and years, and eventually became so disgusted with the agency's practices that she left and started her own nonprofit sliding scale adoption agency. And she was telling me that this particular agency, and this is not uncommon amongst big agencies, they actually had a private jet. And because agencies look for women all across the country, not just in the state where they live, it's competitive. They want these expectant women to want to sign with their agency and pick one of their adoptive families that they have on file. And so she was like, yeah, they would fly a private jet out to see these women. They would take them out to dinner. They would, you know, set them up with like some clothes and not bribe them outright. Everything was technically legal, but she was like, it just left a really bad taste in my mouth that I felt like they were preying upon these women and women who are vulnerable, women who might be young, and just in a really stressful situation. And they are using, you know, money and all of these kind of fancy things and throwing them around in this woman's face, trying to get her to sign with them. That's not fair. And that's not okay. And that's really gross. Like, this is a life-changing decision for both this mother and her child. And to be able, I don't know, I just don't know how you could sleep at night knowing that, you know, you flew a private jet out to see a mother across the country and took her to a super fancy steak dinner and, you know, put her up in a nice hotel for a few nights, and then she decided to go with your agency. Like, ew, it's just gross. And then the fact that these attorneys at this particular agency in town got so wealthy off of this. I mean, you know, the money that you're paying, the $50,000, it's not going to the mother, it's going to the attorneys. And so they're getting extremely rich off of essentially selling babies is what it is. And I just think that if you want to get rich in law, then that's great, but you should not do it in adoption law. You should go into corporate law or some other field. Like, I feel like all adoption agencies and adoption attorneys should operate in a nonprofit model. Like, I don't know how that's not a thing. It is weird that you can, you know, make a killing off of babies. But there we are. So it just seems very transactional. It's very much like, hey, I'll give you $55,000. Great, I can get you a baby in 3 months or less. Or if you're like, you know what, I want to do this more ethically, and also I can only spend $10,000, then it might not ever happen for you. Money talks in the adoption world. And a lot of these agencies will use that in their marketing. They'll say, like, our average placement time is 3 months. Well, yeah, because you have to pay a crap ton of money for these big agencies to network on your behalf. And I don't know. That's just kind of gross. So ethical agencies certainly exist. Nonprofit agencies exist. As I mentioned, agencies who work who charge fees on a sliding scale exist, but it's really hard for them to stay alive because they are competing with these major agencies who can afford private jets and who are charging all this money. And so the smaller agencies don't make as many matches because they're just not finding as many women because they don't have all the budget and the sway to impress these women. And so therefore, because they don't make as many matches, they're not signing as many hopeful adoptive parents. Because if you're looking at two different agencies and one tells you, you can have a baby in 3 months or less, and the other tells you it could be 3 years if it ever happens at all, you know, you're probably going to go with a bigger agency who can get this done faster for you. So it's just kind of sad. So once you look at an adoption agency, you can also add on this other service called an adoption consultant. And consultants are not legal in all states. I believe they're legal in Indiana. But a consultant is basically another person who networks and advertises on your behalf to get you a baby. And I don't know. I can understand how you justify an adoption agency because of the support they can give the birth mother. And in some states, you actually have to go through an agency. You can't do a self-match. But I don't know how you can ethically justify a consultant. Like, the only reason why an adoption consultant exists is to get someone a baby faster. They don't actually add any value to the birth mother, and they don't really add any value to the baby itself. So I've never heard anyone make an argument as to why adoption consultants exist, other than the fact that people just want a baby faster and they have more money to throw around. So a consultant will work with multiple agencies to try to get you that match faster. And typically people use them on top of an agency. So I might sign with agency A, but maybe it's been like 3 months and we still don't have a baby. So I'm going to add a consultant on top of it. And that consultant will work with 17 different agencies across the country while agency A is also working for me. And we'll see who can get me a baby the fastest. And consultants typically are anywhere from like $3,000 to $7,000, and try to find you a baby. It's kind of icky, and I can see why some states do not allow consultants. So this is why we do self-matching. This is why the only way I want to do this is either if it ends up happening through foster care or self-matching. First of all, it's much more economical. You're only paying for the attorney's fees, the birth mother expenses, and potentially some traveling. So attorney fees for the adoption itself are actually pretty inexpensive. When I was talking to our attorney that we did Jack's adoption through, and I said, hey, how much would you guys charge for a private adoption? They were like, yeah, you're looking at about $4,000. So when you look at the agencies who are saying our average adoption is between $35,000 and $55,000, but only $4,000-ish dollars of that are legal fees, you've got to wonder, like, why are you padding this so much? Like, it's just kind of icky. So you've got roughly like $4,000 in legal fees if you self-match. Again, of course, depending on what adoption attorney you go with. And then birth mom expenses. So expectant mothers can get reimbursed or essentially get paid for their living expenses while they are pregnant and for a certain period of time after they give birth. Usually it's like 30 or 60 days. And each state regulates how much birth mothers can get. So it's not like there's just like an endless cap, and they all have to be for legitimate things. So it can be for rent, it can be for groceries, it can be for utilities or transportation. But you couldn't, for example, say, wink, wink, nod, nod, here's $75,000, you know, and try to sway that in your favor. And here in Indiana, the max amount that you can pay for birth mom expenses is $3,000. So not a lot, really. So now you've got $4,000 of legal fees, you've got $3,000 of birth mom expenses, and then, you know, some travel if you know, you've got a, if birth mom is in a different city and you have to travel there for a little bit. So, you know, through a self match, you're looking at $10,000 kind of max for that to happen versus $30,000 to $60,000 privately. Now, self-matches can also happen for not great reasons. So some people want to self-match simply because it's the cheapest option to go, even though it might take them longer to find a woman and to make a match. They just want cheap, and they will cut corners by not offering or connecting the mother with any kind of supportive services. So again, as I mentioned, that perk of working with an agency is that they do look out for the mom. Ideally, of course, they offer counseling and those support groups and things like that. But there are some really great national organizations, nonprofit organizations, designed specifically for mothers who have placed their children in an adoption. And so that is still something that you can include, and you can connect your birth mother to those organizations if she decides to place a child with you so that she does have that support. So, you know, for us, it's really important that she feels good about her decision and her mental health is taken care of, and she's got people to talk to who know exactly what she's going through. And so we want to be really careful that even if we self-match, that we are still connecting her to those services she needs and not just making the quote-unquote transaction and wishing her best of luck. I mean, I think the other reason why I really like the self-matching is it just feels more personal. You know, with an agency, they might represent, you know, 100 different families, and they literally have like this book with your pictures and a couple of sentences about you that they put in front of these expectant women, and these women flip through and, you know, narrow it down to a few people that they want to learn a little bit more about, and then they pick one. But I think because of the way that Jack's adoption has gone with his open adoption, where we have a really great relationship with his birth parents and, in fact, his entire birth family, that's important to me. I don't see this as we're finding a pregnant woman whose baby we can adopt. It's like we're finding somebody that we can have a relationship with for as long as I am alive. Like, this woman and the father, if he's in the picture, and their families will be a part of our lives. And I hope that they're a part of our lives forever. And so naturally, I love the idea of being able to make those connections myself. And I love the idea of a woman, you know, reading my profile that I wrote and connecting with me right away to build that relationship and to get to know each other, rather than like picking each other off of a shelf from a selection that an agency has shown us, you know. So it just feels a little bit more natural and personal, I guess, to do a self-match. It doesn't feel like you're buying a baby. It feels like you really are truly finding two new family members that you are adding to your family. So like I said, I mean, this is something that could take us years, and it could very well never happen. And that's okay with us. We will always continue to foster and host. But yeah, we'll see. So that is our plan or intention for growing our family in the future. So I mentioned earlier that I was also going to do a quick rant, and this one might be a little controversial. And I'm going to call out an organization that I actually really love, but I just take issue with a campaign that they are running. So there's an organization called Together We Rise, and they are all about raising awareness for children in foster care, specifically older children. And it's a great organization. They do amazing things, so you should definitely follow them and give to them and get involved with them. However, they have done this campaign lately where they are trying to get people to donate socks to children in foster care. And as a foster mom, this really rubs me the wrong way. First of all, like, we don't need socks. No foster parent in the entire country would put socks in the top 50 list of things that they need. when they're fostering. Because first of all, socks are really cheap. So yes, like most of the time when children come, the only socks they will come with are the socks on their feet, if they have socks at all. However, socks are really inexpensive and you can get them easily. Like I can run down to the drugstore and get a pack of socks for $1.99. Like not a big deal. We can scratch that off my list. And socks are not changing the life of a foster child. Like, again, they might need them, but that's the foster parent's job to provide them. And it's not a big ticket item and it's not hard to source. Like, nobody needs socks. So this is an example, in my humble opinion, of giving back in a way that feels really good to the person who's doing the giving, but actually makes no impact at all. And I'm just a little confused as to how this organization, who I think is really fantastic, somehow decided that socks were a thing that was like a really pressing need in the foster care community. It is not. Things that foster kids need are more foster parents, right? That's the number one problem, is there aren't enough foster parents to go around and there aren't enough great foster parents to go around. So one, we need more foster parents. Two, we need more volunteer CASAs. So that's a court-appointed special advocate. It's a volunteer who takes a lot of training and they sort of act as a volunteer advocate for children. And they work with the foster child and they work with the the foster parent. And when they go to court, they talk to the judge and tell them what they think is in the best interest of the child. Like, it's so valuable. Great CASAs can make or break a child's future. So, okay, we've got more foster parents and CASAs, two things we definitely need. We need more mentors. So let's say, okay, I can't be a foster parent and it's too much of a commitment to be a volunteer CASA. Great, no problem. We just need more mentors, more people in a foster child's life who are around to tutor them, to take them to their games, to just be another trusted adult they can build a relationship with. The fourth thing we need as foster parents is more financial support. It is expensive to foster, and the per diem that you get per month does not even cover a fraction of your costs. I've gone into this in many other podcast episodes, so I won't get into it here. But in a lot of states, in fact, in most states, daycare and childcare is not paid for, not even by like half. So we need laws and legislation, or, you know, just perhaps private donors to give foster parents the resources they need to be able to care for these children while they're working. You know, like, wouldn't it be cool if some of these organizations could get like a national childcare chain, like a KinderCare or something, to at every center, there are three spots that are given free to children in foster care. Like, wouldn't that be amazing? Like, let's do a drive for everybody. Instead of donating a freaking pair of socks that nobody actually needs, how about you take that money and you put it in a fund and then you try to get that to the children who need daycare that foster parents are just like going broke paying for? That would be really great. We also need better laws in foster care that are looking out for the children, that are giving foster parents rights. And then I think if you are interested in doing something materially, like if this organization was like, okay, that's all well and good, but we want something that's like really easy to market to, really easy to advertise, something that people can buy and feel like they did something, then let's go for a bigger ticket item that foster kids and that foster parents actually need and might not be able to afford. So things like laptops, especially now that we are in virtual schooling, you know, printers and computer equipment are necessary, and kids don't always get them for free at school, and foster parents don't always have the money. So that would be great. Bikes are expensive. That would be really awesome too. Like, think of some of these bigger ticket items that a typical foster parent would be really stretched to afford, but that a foster child might need. So, I mean, again, like, Together We Rise is a fantastic organization. Like, nobody's dying because they're trying to have a sock drive, right? Like, I suppose something is better than nothing, but they're just putting, I see all the effort that they're putting into the promotion of this and the advertising of it, and the people who are really proud of themselves for donating socks, and bless them because their intentions are good, but nobody needs socks. We got socks covered. Like, I promise you, every foster parent right now is like, yes, I can absolutely pay $2 for a package of socks. There are other things that are much more pressing. Please get me those things. So I just, it makes me sad. I'm just like, and same with the suitcase drive. So the same organization and other organizations hold a drive for suitcases so that when foster children are bounced around from home to home, instead of putting all their things in a trash bag, they can put it in a suitcase. Like, I get it. And also suitcases can be expensive. So I get it. But it, that again is almost insulting. Like, hey, child in foster care, we see that you're being bounced around a lot because there aren't enough good foster homes, and there aren't enough foster homes, period, and there aren't enough supportive services to keep you in a foster home. But instead of like addressing all that stuff, we're just going to give you a suitcase so that when you do get bounced around, at least you've got a nicer bag to put your stuff in. Like, no, that's not what these kids need. They need our things that keep them from having to bounce around so that they don't ever need a suitcase unless they're going on a vacation. And if they're going on a vacation, I'm assuming their foster parents can afford a suitcase. So again, it's like, it's well-intentioned. And so I don't want to, you know, turn people off from trying to help. But like, let's direct energy and effort and resources into things that are going to move the needle. And socks and suitcases are like kind of insulting to the kids and the foster parents, and they're actually not needed. So if you were going to donate a suitcase or a sock, maybe like do a cash donation to some of these organizations, or maybe save that money and try to become a foster parent yourself where you can actually move the needle. So That's my rant for today, guys. I haven't done a rant in a while, so I feel like that's justified. Anyway, as always, thank you for listening. Feel free to reach out to me with any questions or comments you have. Instagram at efriedland or elizabeth.friedland@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, leave me a review on Apple Podcasts, because that means that they will bump up my podcast to people who are looking for foster care and adoption related things to listen to. And hopefully people will listen to this and be inspired to not donate socks and instead become a foster parent. So, thank you guys. Until next time.